Arizona economists expect the state to add jobs over the next few years. But the question is, what kinds of jobs? And how will those jobs impact the state's economy?
We need to make sure that we have the industry mix, or that we at least work on generating an industry mix that's going to be favorable to individuals with high levels of education.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, SRP approves a rate hike. Opponents worry about its impact on the residential solar industry. How close should regulators get to those they're regulating? And a piece of Phoenix history could be on its way back, this time on wheels.
There isn't a day that goes by that I don't hear from a customer who has been going there, or had been going there for years, or I'm asked, when is it coming back?
Plus, a dictionary on the wall and the history of a nickname. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. If you're enjoying the sunshine, do it now, because the clouds will start to roll in tonight. Good chance of showers over the weekend. Look for a high tomorrow of 67 for a high on Sunday. Right now, it's 75 degrees under sunny skies. In Valley traffic, accidents, I-70 northbound at McDowell, 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway at 32nd Street, and the 60 westbound at Mill. When Northern Trust decided to expand its operations by opening a new office in Tempe, like a lot of other companies, it received a tax incentive. Tempe Mayor Mark Mitchell says the city council voted and approved the measure Thursday. In exchange for that,
that money is about $7 million. They're reinvesting that money into an endowment for the Tempe Center for the Arts to help make that more, you know, sustainable and viable for our community. So it's the taxpayers of Tempe really benefit from this.
Mitchell says the incentive is performance-based, meaning Northern Trust has to complete all the phases of its project. Former Arizona Congressman Rick Renzi has reported to a federal prison in West Virginia to start serving a 3-year sentence for corruption, money laundering, and other convictions. Renzi previously succeeded in postponing the start of his sentence, but the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on Monday he had to report to prison today. A Bureau of Prison spokesman says Renzi has arrived at the Minimum Security Federal Correctional Institution in Morgantown, West Virginia. Renzi was convicted of conspiring to use his congressional office to make companies buy land owned by his former business associate so that associate could repay a debt he owed to Renzi. Renzi represented Arizona's first congressional district from 2003 until 2009. We step back out on the ledge one more time this week to check in on the goings-on at the state capitol, and joining me is Howie Fisher of Capitol Media Services. Hi, Howie.
I'm going to jump.
Don't do it, man. So one of the things that was going on this week is a kind of a continuation of the dispute between Governor Doug Ducey and Superintendent of Public Instruction Diane Douglas, or at least an attempt to clarify that and maybe resolve it, right?
Exactly. While on the surface it seems to be between Ducey and Diane Douglas, obviously the real party in interest, if you want to call it that, was the State Board of Education. The question becomes, who controls the employees of the Board of Education? Now, we have a very interesting situation in Arizona where the school superintendent is elected, but it is the State Board of Education that the Constitution gives the authority to set policy to within the confines of what the legislature allows. So the clarifying legislation goes back to what everyone thought was going on, which is board employees belong to the board. The board gets to hire them, the board gets to fire them, and the board gets to direct what they do.
This week also saw kind of a back to the future moment as far as payday loans, or something similar to payday loans, in Arizona.
Well, they're not payday loans, but they sure as heck ain't your credit card. You may remember that in 2008, voters by a wide margin said, we don't want payday lending in Arizona. This new loan is something called a flex loan. Now, on paper, the flex loans charge only 36% interest, which is the statutory cap. But then they have, quote unquote, traditional fees that they're tacking on, which can be 0.5% per day. So you could end up in a situation where if you're borrowing $3,000, you're paying $15 a day or $450 a month for that note, and you end up somewhere north of 200% of interest. The proponents say, look, for some people, that's their only choice. The question becomes, at what point does it become usurious, whether it's a moral perspective or a legal perspective?
Howie, on Monday, the state will be in court dealing with a lawsuit over the Independent Redistricting Commission. Can you give us a sense of what this case is about and what the results might mean?
Very simply, in 2000, voters created this Independent Redistricting Commission, taking the chore or the task, or whatever you want to call it, of setting up legislative and congressional districts from the legislature and giving it to this five-member commission. The question comes up that under the U.S. Constitution, it says it is up to the legislature, capital L, to determine the time, place, and manner of congressional elections. Now, the argument by state lawmakers, at least the Republican lawmakers who challenge this, is we are the legislature, not the Independent Redistricting Commission. That argument didn't hold a lot of water when it went to a three-judge panel here in Phoenix, and they said, well, that's true. The Independent Redistricting Commission is not the legislature, but the ultimate legislative power belongs to the people of the state of Arizona pursuant to the Arizona Constitution, and the people delegated that particular legislative power to the Independent Redistricting Commission. Now the U.S. Supreme Court is going to decide, does legislature mean the 90 people, or does it mean the people of Arizona, or does it mean the Independent Redistricting Commission, which was delegated that authority?
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks so much as always.
You're very welcome.
The SRP Board of Directors has voted to raise rates for all of the utility's customers. The increase was controversial for its potential impact on the solar industry. KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Hansen spent yesterday at the hearing and joins me now. Hi, Christina.
Hi there.
So how did the board come to this decision?
Well, SRP hadn't done a rate hike for about 2.5 years, and it usually does that every 2 years or so. So this move really wasn't unexpected. It got so much attention this time because it singled out solar customers with some additional charges, which a lot of people felt was unfair and would only disincentivize people to go solar. SRP had been considering this rate hike since December, but a common theme yesterday was complaints that SRP was rushing into a decision. And here's what SRP solar customer Larky Hodges said yesterday during the meeting.
Please ask management to work openly and honestly with all affected parties, including the solar companies. Please, please, do not let management bully you into an uninformed and rushed vote.
So, Christina, what will be different now for SRP customers?
So the 3.9% rate increase will be phased in starting in April, and it will take full effect a year later. So by then, residential customers will pay about $5 or $8 a month more on average, depending on the type of plan that they have. But that's just an average. It'll definitely vary by customer. As for the solar charge, it really applies to new solar customers, and they'll pay about $50 more a month on average. But again, that depends on their usage during peak hours, so that figure, of course, will also vary. And this won't impact existing solar customers initially because SRP allowed them to be grandfathered into their current rates for up to 20 years. And those grandfathered rates stay in place even if the house sells.
So how does this compare to what APS tried to do in 2013? Could this impact what APS proposes going forward in this realm?
It's hard to say because SRP is self-governing and APS is regulated by the Corporation Commission. So the process of approving new fees and rates at SRP versus APS, they're really different worlds. But the issue is similar. APS wanted to do a $50 to $100 fee on solar, but the Corporation Commission only approved a $5 fee. And some felt this solar fee should have been considered as part of a rate hike with APS, which is exactly what SRP did yesterday.
So, Christina, yesterday's hearing lasted most of the day. What were the arguments for this rate increase, and what were the arguments against it?
Only two of the 14 board members voted against the rate hike yesterday, and Keith Woods was one of them, and he said the decision was rushed, and SRP didn't give the solar industry and commercial customers especially enough input beforehand.
You know, at least at that point that there would be a discussion to agree to disagree. And I felt that we didn't achieve that when we came forth here. It's as if the cake were half-baked with those two different classes of customers.
SRP says the rate hike also helps avoid a budget shortfall this upcoming year for them. And it also helps them pay for big investments it's been making in maintaining the grid and buying a new natural gas power plant.
KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Hansen. Christina, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
Earlier this week, published reports surfaced that a whistleblower had accused former Arizona Corporation Commissioner Gary Pierce of some questionable decisions related to businesses he was involved with regulating. One of the allegations against Pierce is that he met on a number of occasions, including for lunch, with Arizona Public Service CEO Don Brandt. The Corporation Commission sets APS's electric rates. To find out more about what can happen when regulators appear to cozy up with the utility or business they're regulating, we turn to Patrick McLaughlin, senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He says the concept of regulatory capture is key.
That refers to situations where a regulatory agency acts to advance the interest of, say, one or maybe sometimes multiple specific interest groups, and that could be the utilities, for example, rather than to advance overall public interest, which is what you would want out of a regulator. The danger of regulatory capture increases when an agency is more narrowly focused on a specific interest group or a specific industry.
Okay, well, why is that?
At least partly what we call the revolving door. So the revolving door refers to when personnel working in the government, say at a regulator, leave and then go work in the regulated sector. So maybe they go work for the utilities themselves. And sometimes this goes back and forth, and they'll revolve as the name implies.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing inherently wrong with the revolving door. It could be a good thing, in fact, if it results in more informed regulations, maybe more efficient compliance with regulations. But I think it's also obvious that it could be a bad thing. Individual employees who are working at these regulatory agencies and legislators, too, for that matter, may be tempted to design policy, design regulations that will benefit that employee in her next job rather than design regulations that actually solve otherwise intractable problems.
Patrick, what about the expectations we should have for elected officials or regulators to realize, whether they're doing something untoward or not, that the perception indicates that they might be? Shouldn't we expect them to be smarter, savvier than that, appearing to be more above board than that?
Yeah, there is, at least at the federal level, a fairly broad recognition that you want to avoid both actual conflicts of interest and perceived conflicts of interest. There are restrictions that exist for federal employees or regulators, restrictions on receiving gifts, for example, restrictions on when employees of these agencies are supposed to communicate with the regulated entities or interest groups. It's not a ban per se. It's just that there's processes that have to be followed and transparency that, transparency is generally required at all stages when there is such communication. This is sort of created in recognition that on the one hand, you don't want to ban communication between the regulators and the regulated entities because that's actually a wonderful source for information on maybe how you could most efficiently solve some problem. But on the other hand, as you say, you want to avoid perceived conflicts of interest or real conflicts of interest.
Patrick McLaughlin is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Washington University. His research focuses on regulations and the regulatory process.
Still to come, a Valley school has transformed itself into an art gallery.
There's been a lot of conversation around words and what they mean, and that words have many layers of meanings.
That's ahead. It's the show. Quick check of Valley traffic, one accident to tell you about. It's on the 60 westbound at Mill, blocking the shoulder. We'll look for the partly sunny skies to continue throughout the rest of the afternoon with a high of 76. Clouds start to roll in tonight. Slight chance for some rain, mainly after midnight. Overnight lows should be in the mid to upper 50s. Mostly cloudy skies on the way for the weekend. 30% chance of rain tomorrow, up to 50% tomorrow night, 70% on Sunday, with highs in the mid to upper 60s both days. Right now in Phoenix, under sunny skies, 75 degrees at KJZZ at 218.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, announcing their seafood extravaganza with a selection of fresh seafood and shellfish flown in daily. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
State economists have released their forecast for job growth in Arizona over the next couple of years. They're projecting 2.2% growth this year and a little better than that next year. But they also say many of those jobs will not require more education than a high school diploma. To find out more about what that might mean, we turn to George Hammond. He's director of the Economic and Business Research Center at the Eller College of Management at the U of A, and he says the state's forecast is pretty much in line with his.
Most of the jobs that we'll see added over the next couple of years are going to be in service-providing sectors, you know, like healthcare, trade, transportation, utilities, professional and business services, which is where some of the higher tech jobs tend to be, leisure and hospitality, and other sectors that are primarily involved in providing services.
Where do those kinds of jobs tend to fall as far as skill level, education level, wages, things like that?
There are a mix of skill requirements and wages that really vary tremendously across service providing sectors. So, you know, in education and healthcare, you know, the healthcare jobs will include nurses, but also doctors and others involved in providing healthcare who are highly skilled and make relatively high wages. And we see the same thing across, you know, sectors like retail trade. You know, that will also include managers and others that have fairly high levels of education and make fairly high wages.
So as an economist and somebody who does this kind of forecasting, are you satisfied with both the number of jobs that the state is expecting to add and the types of jobs that those might be?
Well, we would certainly like to see Arizona grow faster. That's certainly what we're used to. But, you know, in terms of the mix of jobs, you know, we always want to see more higher wage, high skill jobs. And one of the reasons for that is that one very consistent correlation that we see in the economic data is that states and local areas that have higher concentrations of highly educated individuals, say those with a bachelor's degree or better, tend to grow faster over the long run than regions with lower concentrations. And, you know, Arizona's educational attainment rates, you know, in the neighborhood of the national average or a little bit below at the moment. And we've actually been losing ground with respect to the national economy. In other words, you know, if we go back to 1940, Arizona had the fourth highest share of its population with a bachelor's degree or better. And at the moment, we're in the kind of the middle of the distribution.
So given where Arizona is relative to the rest of the country as far as educational attainment, it seems like that might be kind of a chicken and the egg kind of situation where jobs can't come somewhere where there aren't people who have the skills to do them, but people might not try to get that extra educational level if there aren't the jobs there that can support that.
Well, there's a feedback that can occur in these kind of situations. So we do tend to see this kind of cumulative causation effect where the states and local areas that have high concentrations of highly educated individuals tend to attract firms, and the firms attract workers, and it's kind of like a rock that gets started rolling downhill, and it just gains momentum as it goes. And this is part of the concern for Arizona, because it can be difficult for state and local areas to increase their levels of educational attainment, particularly in the short run. So it's something that states need to pay attention to, and that in particular Arizona needs to pay attention to. We need to make sure that the state is generating individuals that are as highly educated as possible. We need to make sure that we have the industry mix, or that we at least work on generating an industry mix that's going to be favorable to individuals with high levels of education.
George Hammond is director of the Economic and Business Research Center at the Eller College of Management at the University of Arizona. George, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. When the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the Voting Rights Act in 2013, it was hailed as either an acknowledgement of greater racial parity in southern districts with a history of legal segregation, or it was condemned as a gutting of the act that protects minority rights against majority rule temptations to bring back something like this.
I ain't stirring no fuss. I'm just here trying to register to vote.
Recite the Constitution's preamble.
We the people of the United States. In order to form a more perfect union.
How many county judges in Alabama?
67.
Name them.
That example of a discriminatory barrier to black voters from the movie Selma is illegal today and long gone. But when the Supreme Court lifted the federal oversight voting rules in historically segregated districts, they also opened a window on the various rules for voting all over the country. Now, a new study from Harvard has begun to look at data that reveals the effect of bias in a bureaucratic voting process with rules that may not be well understood. Ariel White and Noah Nathan are PhD candidates in government at Harvard and the study's authors. One thing they've found is that racial bias is clearly one reason some voters may not make it to the polls.
What we're actually finding is a much more subtle implicit bias that's similar to bias that's been found in all sorts of other experiments similar to ours in other fields with loan officers, HR workers, doctors, real estate agents, that show that people, when they make discretionary decisions about others, can be implicitly biased to minorities and how helpful they're going to be, even if they don't actually intend ill. To those people. And that's something that we find in our experiment. So the people who didn't give as accurate or as informative responses to Latinos weren't being intentionally inaccurate or constructing barriers. They just weren't being as helpful and as forthcoming as they could be. And they might not even be aware that they themselves are being biased. But the aggregate effects of this in the population are that people from minority groups may be getting less informative information when they ask questions to these officials.
So is it fair to say that under the current system that you looked at, there is a system out there that permits bias, even if it doesn't actually structurally encourage bias in the way we saw in the movie Selma?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think the point is that individuals, when they make discretionary decisions about others, can be implicitly biased in all sorts of ways. And if we don't take that into consideration when we design and implement these policies, we can get biased outcomes, even if bias wasn't the intent going in.
So, Ariel, if a system permits bias, what actually happens at the level of voters that would cause them not to go to the polls?
We looked at just one manifestation of this, which is, you know, we emailed asking for some basic information, just as we would think that voters might do. Certainly, a lot of local officials sent some very helpful and thorough responses.
Which is good.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that we did find, though, was that on average, when we sent those emails, the same text of the same email from a Latino-sounding name, we got fewer responses overall. So we just more often heard radio silence. And we got slightly less thorough responses. So maybe someone would say, yes, you need to bring an ID, such as a driver's license, but actually you could bring all sorts of other IDs and they wouldn't mention that. So just slight differences in quality.
Now, slight, of course, is, the devil is in the details about
exactly.
All of this. Because you add up a bunch of slights and all of a sudden you've got, 10, 20 electoral votes at risk here. In looking at this kind of thing that you're seeing, and again, this is the first real data that anyone's really even talked about, which is what's so interesting here. Can you see any way of correcting, challenging, creating the sort of legal framework to protect voters in this environment versus the much blunter situation that was the case in Selma in, the 1960s?
We didn't find the bias that Ariel was mentioning in a certain subset of jurisdictions in the United States, and those were jurisdictions that were covered for preclearance under several provisions of the Voting Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And these are areas that have additional federal scrutiny of local election procedures to make sure that they don't discriminate, and we found that in these areas, the officials didn't discriminate in their responsiveness or in the accuracy of their responses to our questions. We can't say that that's specifically because of the Voting Rights Act, but it's suggestive evidence that when you have people looking over your shoulder and making sure you aren't biased. And so procedures that explicitly recognize that bias exists and try to take precautions against it are probably necessary to make sure that it doesn't come to the forefront in situations like this.
The huge takeaway here that comes out of your very careful, examination of this data suggests that, the argument that was very passionate right after the Shelby decision, which was, oh, my goodness, the preclearance, which was challenged as an onerous, humiliating regulation on these specific counties based on history that's changed is actually, based on your data, a great idea to have everywhere in the country. Is that what your data is seeming to hint at right now, Ariel?
I do think that, as Noah said, there's room for monitoring here to change people's behavior in terms of implicit bias. I'm not sure I would go quite that far. Noah, what do you think?
I think the best analogy here actually comes from Justice Ginsburg in the Shelby decision, in which she argued, you know, you're not getting wet. Is that because it's not raining or because you're holding up an umbrella? And the question is, should you close the umbrella? And that was the decision that they made, was to close the umbrella, get rid of the Voting Rights Act, those provisions at least. And I think what we can show you is that, yes, even these jurisdictions that are covered by the Voting Rights Act, they're not getting wet, but everyone else is getting wet everywhere else in similar jurisdictions around the country. And so you can connect the dots as to whether the umbrella of the Voting Rights Act is doing the work there. And I think there's suggestive evidence that that's the case. And I do agree that thinking about how to monitor against discrimination everywhere might be the solution to this.
Ariel White and Noah Nathan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, my pleasure.
Ariel White and Noah Nathan are PhD candidates in government at Harvard University and co-authors of this new study on bias in the voting system. They were talking with The Takeaway's John Hockenberry.
Forming concepts and strategies and solving problems based on what we learn from nature may sound daunting, but in the past couple of decades, the idea has gained momentum as biomimicry. At ASU is trying to become a cornerstone for the discipline by launching the Biomimicry Center next Tuesday in collaboration with the firm Biomimicry 3.8. Dana Baumeister is one of the co-founders.
So biomimicry is both an art and a science. It's an emerging discipline that looks to nature for advice to help solve human design challenges. It's asking nature how she might solve some of the biggest issues that we face today, and drawing inspiration from and emulating those strategies that have worked for millions, if not billions of years, for the organisms that we share the planet with.
And are there some that come to mind to you that maybe the average person would have heard of on a practical basis?
Well, most of us are familiar with Velcro, which the original inspiration was drawn from looking at the way seed burrs attach to the fur of a dog's coat. And that's a shape form-based form of mimicry. And certainly there's a lot of very interesting innovations just by looking at nature's forms. Some of the more recent work begins to take those forms to a whole new level. The new shape of the front end of the nose of the Shinkansen bullet train in Japan mimics the beak of a kingfisher so that it no longer has a sonic boom as it moves through tunnels, just the way a kingfisher no longer splashes when it dives into water.
Dana, are we all potentially capable of recognizing that this is where sometimes our creative inspiration comes from, or does it take a particular kind of brain to see this and make it work?
Well, it definitely takes a brain that's willing to ask those questions, willing to go for a walk in the woods and say, huh, how would nature solve this? Of course, you can be trained and you can learn specific methods and practices, but really all of us are designers. We all have to solve problems every day. And by going out and saying, hey, how do the locals do it? How's the cactus solving this water issue? It can provide inspiration for how you might solve some of those challenges for yourself.
So that clearly puts it in sort of that sustainability category, too, as opposed to some other aspects of it.
For us, biomimicry is ultimately about asking ourselves, what's worth studying? What's worth doing? Does it make any sense to learn from nature on how to design a better nuclear warhead? Probably not. So nature has sustained and created conditions conducive to life. And as one of the species on the planet, we probably should behave appropriately and learn to solve these challenges in a sustainable way.
Is this something that could have an economic component as well in the concept perhaps of technology transfer, where this is something that not only can perhaps help society and increase sustainability, but also, again, have a component of producing financial rewards?
Absolutely. I mean, when you talk about innovations, this is where it's at. In fact, there was research done and found an overlap between the human patent database and nature's version of her patent database, how she might solve these challenges. And there was only a 12% overlap. So 88% of the time, life is doing something in a completely new and novel way. And that's really what economic development is about, is designing new innovative solutions to our problems. And why not ask nature to help us do that?
Dana Baumeister, she's co-founder of the firm Biomimicry 3.8, which is partnering with ASU in launching the Biomimicry Center. It opens next Tuesday.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. One problem in Valley traffic at this hour. It's on the 60 westbound at Mill. Look for the sunny skies to last basically through the end of the day today. Clouds start to roll in tonight. Slight chance of rain mainly after midnight. Lows tonight should be in the mid to upper 50s. Cloudy skies tomorrow, 30% chance of rain and a high of 69. Chance of rain increases to 50% tomorrow night and up to 70% on Sunday, when the high should reach 67 degrees. Sunny skies over Phoenix right now, 75 degrees at KJZZ at 235.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona Oncology, united with the U.S. Oncology Network to redefine cancer care. Arizona Oncology provides evidence-based cancer treatment and targeted therapies to patients throughout the Phoenix area. More at arizonaoncology.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The fate of a short-term spending bill to fund the Department of Homeland Security is uncertain in the House. The bill had been approved in a vote clearing the way for passage today, but Republican leaders sent the House into recess, trying to round up enough votes needed to pass it. Democrats are opposed to just 3 weeks of funding instead of a full year. President Obama says he's not happy about the length of the funding, but spokesman Josh Earnest says Obama wants to keep the agency open.
If the president is faced with a choice of having the Department of Homeland Security shut down or fund that department for a short term, the president is not going to allow the agency to shut down.
If there is no action, DHS will start to shut down at midnight, furloughing 30,000 workers. Another 200,000 will have to report to work, but without pay. Liberia's President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf met with President Obama in the Oval Office today, discussing cooperation on the Ebola crisis and more. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, Ebola cases in Liberia are down significantly.
Sirleaf was supposed to visit the White House in August as part of an All-Africa Leadership Summit focused on the economy. Instead, she remained in her country, battling what at the time was an overwhelming crisis. Now, with Sirleaf sitting by his side, President Obama says extraordinary strides have been made in driving back Ebola.
Cases are now down 95% from their peak.
In part, at least, because of international assistance, including from the U.S. military. But Obama says the job is not complete. The leaders pledged to work together to eliminate Ebola in West Africa and to rebuild and grow the Liberian economy. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The White House.
Wall Street lower by the closing bell. The Dow down 81 points, Nasdaq down 24. This is NPR.
The Mayo Clinic's health network could be expanding in Arizona as Tucson Medical Center may be joining. Keith Cannon is a hospital internist at Mayo Clinic in Phoenix and associate medical director of its affiliated practice network.
We have been building a network called the Mayo Clinic Care Network, and it is an affiliation of high-quality, patient-centered medical centers who choose to affiliate with Mayo Clinic in a structure that allows us to expand the expertise and knowledge of Mayo Clinic to a broader array of patients. And as we have faced changes in the healthcare environment, in which we've seen a lot of consolidation, Mayo Clinic has looked for ways to respond. And a lot of times the consolidation that has been occurring has taken the form of mergers and acquisitions, but this is an alternative to that. So in the Mayo Clinic Care Network, Mayo Clinic has non-owned affiliations with these other institutions who are looking to bring more quality to their patients and also in most cases to remain independent.
Are we talking mostly about hospitals? Are there actual practices that are joining this network as well?
the majority of the members are hospitals because hospitals serve as aggregators of physicians and patients and practices. So the relationship has been between Mayo Clinic and a hospital or a health system. And, you know, there's a lot of variety among the members of the care network. Some of them are larger health systems. Some of them are more regional hospitals. And some of them are smaller hospitals that are crucial in their communities. But the relationship has been between Mayo Clinic and those health systems or hospitals.
So what does Mayo get out of this, and what do those hospitals get out of this sort of arrangement?
So I think that it's driven by value. Our board at Mayo Clinic has wanted to make sure that this clinic delivers value. One of our strategic goals is to expand our reach, meaning extending Mayo Clinic knowledge and expertise to more patients. What we offer the members is a way for them to perhaps strengthen or shore up their market share in their own community. They might be able to stem out-migration of patients who would otherwise go somewhere else for a second opinion or to look for specialized services. We do offer the Mayo Clinic Care Network brand. Over the years, Mayo Clinic's been very careful about its brand, and this is new for us to be able to extend that brand to other institutions. We also offer products and services, and this is really at the heart of Mayo Clinic Care Network. And so there are clinical tools that we use within our own practice at Mayo Clinic that we extend to the members.
You mentioned that Mayo over the years has been very careful with its brand. So when you're looking to have a facility join the network, what are you looking for?
So I mentioned that there's a great variety among the members in terms of their size and the configuration of providers and so forth. I think the common denominator among the members is that they are high-quality institutions, meaning that they strive for quality and patient safety. They're patient-centered. Almost all the members of the Mayo Clinic Care Network are not-for-profit organizations, and they are trying to remain independent in their market.
Keith Cannon is Associate Medical Director of Mayo Clinic's affiliated practice network known as the Mayo Clinic Care Network. He's also an internist at Mayo Clinic in Phoenix. This week, a Valley private school welcomed visitors for an open house of sorts, but not to check out the classrooms and curriculum. They were there for an art exhibit.
We started the downstairs tour with the letter J.
Leanne Krakus is Fine Arts Director of Rancho Solano Preparatory School in Scottsdale. She's showing me around Dictionary Days, featuring works by the artist Peter Tunney. There are 26 pieces, all representing a letter of the alphabet, spread throughout the school.
Part of the experience of the exhibit is guessing or understanding which word is being showcased, which letter of the alphabet is being showcased in this work.
Krakus says the letters are not in alphabetical order, and in some cases it can be kind of hard to tell what letter a print represents. The pieces are here, at least in part, because a parent knows the artist and helped arrange for the exhibit. The pieces themselves are pretty big and include pages from a 1920s dictionary with color blocking and layering on top. Dr. Audrey Menard is head of school at Rancho Solano.
There's been a lot of conversation around words and what they mean, and that words have many layers of meanings. And so it has definitely raised the level of conversation.
Menard says the school aims to help its students become innovators, and that going a little old school is helping in that effort.
In this age of technology, as I'm holding my cell phone, you know, people have stopped using words in the way that they used to be.
The tours are generally led by student docents. Menard says that's teaching them how to look someone in the eye and give them information. Eighth grade art student Sophie Wu is one of the docents. She calls the exhibit inspiring.
It's beautiful, and we're learning from it. We're doing print and stuff.
What are you learning from having the pieces here?
It teaches us this is more like pop art. Like, it makes you rethink what is art. And when we see this, you like examine the aspects of it, and you're like, wow, this is cool.
As we head upstairs to see the 16 pieces on the second floor, Fine Arts Director Leanne Krakus says she sees students and teachers stopping to look at the art. She says the pieces require critical thinking, a skill the school tries to impart on its students.
All of our classes, arts, language, arts, science, math, are not about finding the answer right away, but how do you know what you know? And can you legitimize and analyze why you know that, and in a very high level of thinking, be able to give reason for what you believe?
Head of school Audrey Menard echoes that sentiment and says part of the school's goal is to make its students more comfortable with ambiguity.
You'll see the innovation, the old and the new. You'll see kids having to think and create, you know, what their own impressions are. And we also believe arts are a key part of our education. And so bringing art and education together, so it fits really beautifully with our mission.
Menard says the school encourages students to think about art holistically, who the artist is, what's their inspiration, and how they create their work. Leanne Krakus says this exhibit is helping art students learn about modern art and pop art techniques.
But the fact that the art is spread around the whole school building, that it's completely interdisciplinary, that it has so much language arts, that it has so much history, and it has so much just visual art in it, I think all the kids are just being reminded how art isn't just a thing unto itself, that it truly is the intertwining of everything that they're learning.
The exhibit, Dictionary Days, an exploration of the lexicon A to Z, will be at Rancho Solano in Scottsdale for a year. It'll be open to the public next on March 26th. It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. Next week, we'll bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner Leszek Pavlovich. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. A man spends one-fifth of the money in his wallet. He then spends one-fifth of what's left. In total, he spends $36. How much money did he have to start? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. Good afternoon. You're listening to The Show on 91.5 KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. We're bringing you more of our community mixed with national stories and international news, a service that blends all of what our community is that makes it what it is. In Valley traffic, US 60 westbound, an accident blocks the shoulder at Mill. If you're looking for sunny skies, you'll have to look beyond this weekend. We'll have them for the rest of the day today, but partly cloudy skies start to roll in tonight. Slight chance of rain mainly after midnight. Look for overnight lows in the mid to upper 50s. 30% chance of rain tomorrow with a high of 69. Chance of rain increases to 50% tomorrow night, 70% for Sunday, and the high should reach only 67 degrees. Right now in Phoenix, under sunny skies, it's 75 at KJZZ at 246.
KJZZ is supported by SRP. Doubling the size of their community's solar program with power from a new solar facility in the valley. More at srpgrid.com. SRP, delivering more than power.
In Mexico City, people rely heavily on public transport. There's a system of trains, metros, and buses that caters to about 5 million people a day. So it's a captive audience for the health department's latest initiative. If you do some squats on the way into work, you get free nutritional and fitness advice. And there's talk of giving away free metro tickets, too. The BBC's Katie Watson reports.
Cuatro, muy bien. Cinco, seis, bueno, ahí dice tres, pero lleva siete. Ya llevas ocho, ya llevas nueve, y ahora diez. Excelente, muy bien.
In the middle of one of Mexico City's busiest bus stations, an exercise class is taking place. Omar Cobos works for Mexico City's health department, and he's encouraging some of the capital's 5 million commuters to stop their busy lives for just one moment and do 10 squats in front of him on a specially designed platform. In return, they're given nutritional tips and get a free pedometer too, to keep an eye on how active they are throughout the day.
What we're trying to do is change those food habits, the sedentary habits of not doing anything and always sitting still, to show people they can do 10 squats. Lots of people come here saying, I can't do squats. I get tired, but I motivate people. They can do it, and then they see they can do it and think, cool, they're surprised they can do it.
These so-called health stations are in an initial trial period. Afterwards, Mexico City's health secretary has said he may consider giving away free metro tickets as an incentive if companies sponsor the initiative. So what do Mexico City residents make of it?
Sometimes you have to pay for exercise, but here they teach you how to do it. You don't have to pay or come every day if you don't have time.
It's a good idea, but it would be better if people did it for themselves. They motivated themselves rather than because they are given something.
You only need to walk down the street for a minute or two to see how, as Mexico has grown richer, people have abandoned their traditional diets of corn and beans and replaced it with fried food. I've come to a street corner in my neighbourhood, and there are several stands here selling people lunch. Now, this one in front of me is offering pork tacos with fried tortillas and chips. There's a big cool box on the side selling only soft drinks, Coca-Cola, lemonade, sugary drinks. There's no water as far as I can see in there. It'll definitely take more than 10 squats to work off this lunch.
In fact, Mexicans are now the biggest consumers of fizzy drinks in the world, and that's helped make the country one of the fattest on the planet. It's second after the US when it comes to the number of overweight or obese adults, but has the world's biggest childhood obesity problem, so this new government initiative is welcomed by many experts.
I think it's a great message.
Simon Barquera is an obesity specialist at Mexico's National Public Health Institute.
Having these kind of programs is not only making people do some physical activity, but it's a message from the local governments that they are willing to give you something as incentive to do physical activity, to try to be healthier. So this is very important. This kind of programs send an educational message.
Estamos regalando un podómetro por cada 10 sentadillas que nos regalen.
Back at the squat station, Omar is busy motivating yet more commuters. It's certainly a novelty for many passing through as they stare at the funny positions Omar's making people do. But he hopes that curiosity will encourage at least some people to make changes in their lives.
That's the BBC's Katie Watson in Mexico City. All U.S. states have a nickname. Arizona has been known as the Grand Canyon State for a long time, but it took decades to make it official. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez explains.
It's on car license plates, state line welcome signs, and in just about every information guide about the state. Arizona's nickname has been the Grand Canyon State since about the 1930s. But did you know the nickname was not made official until 2011, when a grade school girl told the state, "You don't have one."
I got a letter. It was from a girl in California, and her name was Victoria Smith, and she was writing a paper on the states. She picked Arizona, and she wanted to know what her official nickname was.
Marshall Trimble is the Arizona State historian.
I could tell right away by her letter. She was very bright. She says, "I did my research, and I could not find where it officially says that Arizona is a Grand Canyon state." And she said, "Mr. Trimble, can you tell me, is it that?" And I said, "I thought it was."
Trimble says he was stumped. So he began researching, and through the state library archives, it was discovered no legislature had ever made the nickname official.
And I told her, I said, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'll make a promise to you. I'm going to get it changed. I'm going to have them change this to the official Grand Canyon State." And it took me 2 years to get it through the legislature down there.
That's because House Bill 2549 was getting stuck in the legislative process. After several months with the help of a freshman state legislator, the bill was pushed through.
When I went down to testify at the state legislature, I said, if we don't look out, somebody else is going to copyright that thing. And they all laughed. And then I kind of jabbed them a little bit. I said, "And you know what? I hear rumors that Las Vegas is thinking of taking the name." And them were fighting words.
On February 14, 2011, Governor Jan Brewer signed into law Arizona's official nickname. And for the occasion, the young California girl was invited to attend the signing. Trimble says this was a life lesson for all.
Because a lot of times you think, oh, my vote doesn't really count. My letter doesn't count. Why do I want to get involved? It won't make a difference anyway. But this, in this case, one letter from one schoolgirl made something big happen here in the state of Arizona.
By the way, Trimble says Arizona has had several nicknames. It was once the baby state for being the last one to enter the Union until Hawaii and Alaska came on board. It was also known as the Valentine State after it became a state in 1912. He says it was even called the Sand Dune State, but the Grand Canyon State was the nickname that stuck. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things that we should know, please tell us about them. You can send us an email at theshow@kjzz.org. A longtime Valley institution could be making a comeback, but in a different form. Mary Coyle's Ice Cream closed last year after more than 60 years in business. But Mike Stofi, who bought the business in 2011, is running a crowdsourcing campaign in an effort to bring Mary Coyle's back as a food truck.
I've talked to a number of people over the last couple of years and have considered the idea of a truck, as I've seen so many food trucks out on the road. But nothing really formal was in place. We really hadn't explored it, at what it would look like or what it would be. So the idea of the truck has really come about in the last 2 or 3 months.
Why does it seem like a good idea to you?
Well, I believe things are just, they're different now. Back when Mary Coyle started in the Valley in 1951, it was a much smaller community, and Mary Coyle's was a gathering spot when it was located down on 15th Avenue and Thomas. So I think now, as the Mary Coyle customer who maybe has lived in that downtown area or had lived in that downtown area has moved to corners of the Valley, or their family has moved to corners of the Valley, I think it's going to be a neat experience to bring the ice cream to them in a slightly different format through a food truck.
Is there something about the ice cream market that makes it a better business model to be mobile than to have a brick-and-mortar location?
I think going to the customers is important in the ice cream business, being in front of the customer. It just doesn't seem realistic to me to have loyal customers of 20, 30, 40 years to necessarily drive to one location when it may be an hour trip for them. I think bringing it to them every so often would just be a wonderful opportunity.
I imagine that you would be hoping to use the memories and perhaps nostalgia of Mary Coyle's in this endeavor.
To me, Mary, it's about the memories and it's about the nostalgia of Mary Coyle's. Been around, like I said, since 1951. That's a long, long, long time. And there isn't a day that goes by that I don't hear from a customer who has been going there, who had been going there for years, or I'm asked, when is it coming back? When is it coming back? We miss it. We're just so looking forward to you bringing it back. So it's important to me that it comes back and I have the opportunity to continue those memories for future generations.
Well, how much of the memories of former customers do you think people have are the actual ice cream and the other things on the menu versus the place?
I think it's both. So there's been a number of different Mary Coyle locations over time. I think the memories are the sitting around the table with your family and friends, sharing homemade ice cream in just a comfortable environment.
How do you find the competition among ice cream trucks? Because as any kid will tell you, especially in the summertime, you hear that jingling music, you would not be the only game in town.
No, we wouldn't be, but I think partnering up with other local food trucks and being at farmers markets and food truck events and community events, I think will be the premier choice for those type of events.
So would you envision being more of like an event kind of thing as opposed to just sort of cruising through neighborhoods hoping to get
absolutely.
Customers that
I don't,
way?
I'm not really anticipating the neighborhood prospect at all.
Mike Stofi is the owner of Mary Coyle Ice Cream. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you for your time.
America loves bacon.
That seems like a generalization.
Yeah, but it's actually the name of a new festival that'll tour the country, and its first official stop is in Arizona. There will be bacon samples, bacon clothing, and bacon cotton candy.
I get the feeling you're kind of excited about this.
Listen to this and tell me it doesn't make your mouth water.
Well, I'm just cooking up some nice chunk bacon for our Hey Ryan pizza we're going to be offering this weekend. It's our version of a Hawaiian pizza.
Jason Cotomy of Saffron Jack Pizza Truck says bacon is not an unfamiliar topping for them. The food truck will be serving samples at the festival, including one of its signature pizzas.
We've made a name for ourselves with our loaded baked potato pizza. It's our best seller.
And Cotomy says he thinks that's because of the bacon.
Okay, a little bacon sprinkled on here and there I get, but a whole festival might seem excessive. That is, until you talk with festival organizer Evan Weinstein about the test run they did in Baltimore.
There was not enough bacon in Baltimore. We had about 17 vendors, and we had about 4 o'clock, we had 3 vendors left and 2-hour waits to get food.
The event sold out with about 4,000 guests. Weinstein says they've learned and will have way more bacon available at the Arizona Festival.
But what makes bacon so appealing? Jessica Lehman is with the Arizona Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics.
The thing about bacon that does make it so delicious is it's very savory and does have something called umami. It's a very delicious and pleasurable taste. It's called the fifth taste.
Lehman says that's the kind of flavor you have to use sparingly.
Which is not what people competing in the bacon eating contest will be doing.
Right, but Lehman also says the trend of combining bacon with different foods can encourage people to try new things.
You know, like a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. So really, you know, a spoonful of bacon can make the kale go down, like much easier.
I don't know if they'll have kale, but you can try all the bacon goodies at the America Loves Bacon Festival. It'll be at Rawhide Western Town in Chandler tomorrow. So here's a question to consider. In what world could Phoenix be just a hop, skip, and a jump away from Chicago or Portland? Well, that world would be the world of Monopoly. Hasbro is celebrating the game's 80th anniversary with a new U.S. edition, and the company is asking you which cities it should feature. Right now, Phoenix is in the top 10 cities of 60 in the running. In this edition, real-life city landmarks take the place of classic property spaces like Boardwalk and States Avenue. So where would Phoenix end up if it does get voted onto the new board? It might make sense to be next to free parking. Another question on our minds, will hotels on the Phoenix Square lose money? You can cast your vote at votemonopoly.com, but don't wait. The contest ends March 4th. Plenty of good stuff going on this weekend. As always, you can catch the Celtic Thunder Vocal Band Sunday night at Mesa Art Center. The 2015 Natural Hair Care and Health Expo is Sunday at the Doubletree Hotel in Tempe. Of course, the America Loves Bacon Festival Saturday at Rawhide. The Native Now Culture Festival is tomorrow at Deer Valley Rock Art Center. And the Lego Kids Fest is all weekend at University of Phoenix Stadium. The show is produced by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Alexandra Olgan, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are our digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer, John Hoban. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD at 3 o'clock.